Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this May 9th Monday. This morning on the Old Mole, in their Left in the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss the political impact of the recent Supreme Court leaked document expressing the intent of SCOTUS to overturn Roe v. Wade. Can we make peace in the Ukraine? Bill Resnick and John Pfeffer discuss the forces, national and international, that could successfully demand a binding settlement. John Pfeffer is director of foreign policy in focus at the Institute for Political Studies. We will conclude this morning's show with Joe Clement interviewing Emily Drabinsky, president-elect of the American Library Association. They talk about her winning campaign, building collective power to fight for public goods, in and with the support of libraries. This is KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, community radio, Portland and beyond. It's KBOO's annual spring membership drive for 2022, and KBOO's independent, locally produced, people-powered community radio is only possible with your support. Through May 28th, listeners, family, friends, and neighbors will have the opportunity to support KBOO Radio, an important part of our community and an indispensable source of news, politics, and entertainment. KBOO is a nonprofit organization with 80% of our funding coming from our members. KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, writers, and KBOO has trained thousands of people to make radio, all for free thanks to the support we receive from our members. And while we aren't in the station to take your calls right now, you can show your support by giving online at kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44-321, or you can give support to the Postal Service and Community Radio by mailing your contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Support KBOO, support Community Radio today. Again, I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. And now it's time for our programming. On the Left in the Law this morning with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, they discussed the political impact of the recent Supreme Court leaked document expressing the intent of SCOTUS to overturn Roe v. Wade. Jan and Mike take up the legal reasoning behind this full-scale assault on abortion rights, how that reasoning is likely to extend into other court decisions, and how the abortion rights and reproductive justice movements need to fight back. Jan?
Mike, on May 2nd, the leaked opinion written by Justice Alito in arguing for overturning Roe v. Wade has been described as both shocking and not surprising. As part of a larger trajectory, it is not at all surprising. Abortion rights advocates have noted the death by a thousand cuts to Roe v. Wade in hundreds of laws passed in state legislatures in recent years, culminating in a de facto ban on abortion in Texas last fall that was upheld by the Supreme Court in a shadow ruling. So, Mike, what is your assessment of what is perhaps surprising and not surprising about this released opinion?
Well, what's surprising, of course, is that they leaked it. It's a very, very rare event in Supreme Court history. The last time had to do with matters related to Roe v. Wade in the 1970s. Normally, they're a very buttoned-up outfit and do not give any previews until they finally release it. What's not surprising is that they are squarely overturning Roe v. Wade. What surprises me is how much they rely on absolutely discredited and ancient and misapplied history to do so in such a way that makes The Handmaid's Tale seem not quite so far-fetched.
But before going into that history or as part of it, can you say a bit about that line of argument and the role of history that's been disputed, both the specific history cited by Alito, but also how we use history, how the Supreme Court reasoning uses history?
Well, there is almost no usual pattern. There are a group of cases that say that obviously in a new world with Snapchat and drones that the Fourth Amendment and other parts of the Constitution have to be updated. You can't simply rely on precisely what was in effect at the time the Constitution was created. But the originalists, or people who believe the Constitution should be interpreted to mean exactly what it meant to the people who wrote it, have managed to persuade most courts, or most of the justices most of the time, that enumerated rights are protected by the 14th Amendment only when they're, quote, deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition, close quotes. Now, they don't always apply that. For example, in Lawrence v. Texas, where they struck down a state law in Texas banning sodomy, the court overruled an earlier decision, Bowers, which had said nowhere did the word sodomy appear in the original Constitution. And they framed it as a matter of people being allowed to do what they want to do in the privacy of their own homes. And there's a dozen cases extending that to the right of being able to live with your extended family, the right to have contraception, the right to essentially be who you are. The right, it's an extension of the right of privacy, has been really developed since the mid-60s and the Griswold v. Connecticut case, when married couples were allowed to buy contraceptives. Actually, that was a controversial issue as late as the 1960s.
Can you say a little bit about the 14th Amendment that has been at the center of both Alito's reasoning and criticisms of his reasoning? Because, you know, it was passed by Congress in 1866, ratified in 1868, that extended civil and legal rights for Black citizens who were formerly enslaved. How did that become the grounds for these rulings related to privacy and protection of one's person that included the right to abortion and other rights that are part of the modern era? What was it about the 14th Amendment?
Well, it really began to happen in the 1930s. Until then, nobody thought that the Bill of Rights had any application to the states. But in the 1930s, the Supreme Court was confronted with these violently coerced confessions, particularly in the Scottsboro Boys case of Alabama. Confessions, of course, are always a great thing for law enforcement. It has been in the 19th century, an English policeman in India said, "Well, it's so much easier to rub red pepper into some poor devil's eyes than it is to run around in the hot sun gathering up evidence." And people have always thought, if you just club this guy and get him to confess, then I won't ever have to go into a dangerous neighborhood. It's very
because there's something about confessions that has, for many people, a kind of face validity.
Well, they, you know, solve everything. They supply every single element of a crime. The case is closed, basically. So the court held that the Fifth Amendment, which guarantees you the right to not have to be forced to testify against yourself, protects you against coerced confessions as a result of the 14th Amendment, which made the original Bill of Rights and the Fifth Amendment applicable to the states. Well, that sort of opened the door, and then other First Amendment rights, for example, the right of Jehovah's Witnesses to knock on your door, and other Fourth Amendment rights were gradually made a part of the law that applies to the states as well as the federal government. And through the 60s, there was a cascade of applying, like, the Sixth Amendment rights to present a defense, to call witnesses on your own behalf. All these rights, which had previously been thought to apply just to the federal government, actually apply right here in Multnomah County and everywhere else in every state prosecution. And so the 14th Amendment has continued beyond criminal defense matters to include issues of privacy, issues of freedom, issues of conducting yourself as you please, and been continually used to expand our rights. The limits to this has been, you know, the originalists have tried to stop all this by saying, look, the rights they say are not enumerated, not explicitly set forth in the Constitution, can only be made to apply if they were, quote, deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. And the court has sometimes blown by that. In the case, for example, Lawrence v. Texas, that struck down the sodomy law, they didn't really talk a lot about that because there have been lots of laws against sodomy throughout our history. They've instead focused on all the applications of the right for people to be autonomous, to be free in their own homes, to conduct themselves as they please. But usually, if you want to get more votes, the more you can closely show that it was rooted in American tradition, the better off you are.
Here we do have an interesting fight that's been part of the whole social history movement, the new historical movement, to not only look at the dominant powers that define history, like the medical profession here, it was very implicated in the Grove campaigns to criminalize abortion in the late 19th century. But there's a whole social history of abortion that's been documented by feminist historians and others that traces that history very differently than the one Alito is citing. Indeed, argues that with substantial evidence that abortion before quickening, which is when the woman feels the movement of the fetus at around 4 or 5 months, that abortion was not criminalized and was freely practiced. Women developed as healers, nurses and midwives, abortifacients that could terminate pregnancy. They were advertised in billboards and newspapers, and it was often described as getting regular again, which is still sometimes used as a euphemism for abortion many places in the world. So it's kind of interesting that the struggle underlying this opinion that has been with us for a long time, including in the critical race theory debates about how we define history and what documents we cite in how we look at history.
Well, here Alito is flat out wrong. For as long as America has existed, there's been abortions. The glaring historical mistakes he's made are that he overlooks the fact that abortion, that is, up until the quickening, as you describe, has been widely accepted and widely practiced. And that was true until really the late 19th century, when as doctors gained power, before they were like barbers, when they made the same amount of money, but they became very powerful and in the late 19th century and were active in promoting anti-abortion laws.
And anti-contraception laws as well. And so there's this affinity of the right of women to end pregnancies. And I think even though women have done this and continue to do it and will continue to end pregnancies, the issue of doing it publicly and collectively emerged as part of a women's movement campaign, because the criminalizing of abortion also emerged during first wave feminism and was an attack on many expressions of female authority and the emerging collective authority of women. So I think that is also part of this assault now on the rights of women to control their own reproduction.
Well, Alito has cherry-picked from moments of the last millennium. I mean, he has to openly acknowledge that our history actually does support a right to abortion for most of early pregnancy. His draft acknowledges that people made the distinction between pre- and post-quickening abortions, and that abortions were criminally punishable only if performed after quickening. But he says this is, quote, of little importance because at the time of the 14th Amendment in the mid-1860s, quote, he says, 28 out of 37 states had enacted statutes making abortion a crime, even if it was performed before quickening. Well, he's flat out wrong. He, for example, includes Oregon as one of those states. But there is an Oregon decision in the early 20th century making it clear that the state does not regard unnecessary abortions as a crime, or any abortion as a crime that happens before quickening. So it's actually more like 16 states out of 37 had laws that forbade women from getting abortions at the time of the 14th Amendment's passage. So that fits comfortably within the standard of law that would be considered a deeply rooted right, according to very orthodox Supreme Court law, the right to have an abortion before fetus quickens.
So Mike, let's turn to what's next and the political avenues available in challenging this opinion, what looks like upcoming basic overruling of Roe v. Wade. How important are the criticisms of Alito's legal reasoning and the shoddy historical documentation of his argument? Also, there's a strain of incredible cruelty and meanness that some people find shocking, not only the ruling, but the tone of it, the disdain for justices that were part of previous rulings, including Roe v. Wade and the Casey ruling. And so how much of these critiques weigh in on fighting the ruling itself and the political train ahead?
Well, they're very important. I mean, Alito is just that way. He's waspish, cranky. He's always been a jerk. That's his mannerisms. And I think his tone is very contemptuous of anybody who's different. But a really striking part that we haven't even reached yet is in his effort to find historical precedent, since he didn't do so well in the first couple hundred years of this country's history, he went back to England and cited Matthew Hale, who was one of the authors of commonly used common law books, 9 times. Hale is the guy who invented the concept of marital rape exceptions. He created the law that said that once you're married, women surrender any right to complain about being raped. This guy also presided over witchcraft trials where 2 people were executed. 2 women were killed on the basis of children who were telling fantastic tales of giant toads leaping around the room and who much later recanted all that. This is the guy who Alito relies on.
So you're saying there's something really important here in a project of exposing the worldview and the authoritative, absolutely, the spirits from the past that we each enlist to guide us in our path through the darkness of the moment. And these are the spirits he invokes that guides this sagacious figure in robes on the court.
Yeah, he quotes Matthew Hale as describing abortion as a, quote, great crime and a, quote, great misprison. He said that in 1673, you know, 9 years after he presided over a witchcraft trial in which he accepted as valued evidence completely preposterous stories and gave women limited their rights to defend themselves and had them executed.
Well, in
so
all
this is
fairness,
who he relies on.
Yeah, Alito does note in apparently his attempt to counter the idea that he is opposed to the rights of women. He says that women now have political authority to voice themselves in many ways, that they don't need to have their rights protected in the form of abortion rights. So I hope he's right that women have enough political authority and voice to summon collectively in fighting this old, not only Alito and the justices, but this extreme right wing that's resurrecting a worldview that opposes much of what we think of as the modern world and modern conception of rights. So how do we think about the path forward? I mean, part of it you're saying is to expose the fraudulence of the Supreme Court and its claims of wisely ruling from above the fray of political life, and that the reactionary worldview that now dominates the court. But what forms should that take?
Well, expression for one. I mean, the fact that his opinion is crabbed, it's grumpy, it's nasty, it's triumphant. It's a combination of provincial arrogance that is based on falsehoods and complete errors, like his totals of which states had what kind of law at what time, his effort to fend off the idea that there was, in fact, a pretty traditional and longstanding presence of abortion in this country's history. All this needs to be pointed out in order to first limit it, if not absolutely overturn it, to discredit it so that it will be overturned.
I mean, there's the campaign that seems unlikely to pass a law in Congress making abortion a right at the federal level, but that seems not likely. The fights that are going to unfold in the upcoming political period in the states can include a number of arguments around how abortion rights is tied to other aspects of life. You know, the Black feminist thought in the 1990s brought in reproductive justice as a framework for thinking about abortion rights and sexuality, the right to bear and care children and raise them in a healthy environment. So it seems quite clear that the right wing in this country is also very intersectional, including the Supreme Court. They have a number of decisions coming up where this same worldview will be applied to other issues. So how Absolutely. Do we think in that same intersectional way as the right wing is in connecting these issues to their particular worldview?
Well, this opinion needs to be discredited, and its author needs to be discredited every way possible, for, among other, first to set up an eventual reversal of this, because the opinion, the court does reverse itself fairly often. That's not an uncommon thing. It's not a bad thing necessarily. We all learn as we get older. Secondly, this reasoning is, as you said, it's poisonous in many directions. The same reasoning that led to a variety of constitutional protections about how you live your life, who you live it with, what you do at home, the whole constellation of cases, whether or not you get castrated if you're a felon. They can't do that because of constitutional protections found under the 14th Amendment. And interpretations by this court, they need to be nipped in the bud by discrediting this case as much as possible, because they do want very badly to extend it in all sorts of directions.
And so this fight goes beyond abortion rights.
It goes beyond in every direction, having to do with your own autonomy. The basis of this decision can be used and will be used by these people to limit your freedoms in dozens of ways, which I think argues for really limiting this court, period, taking steps by either court expansion or by simply passing a law saying that there are ways of legislating to protect freedoms that we should start thinking seriously about. So I think it's a multi-pronged approach. We have to attack the decision itself. We have to attack the person who made it, the institution who made it, because they are, in every sense, reactionary. And the deepest bad senses, they're not restoring the golden eras of the past. They're forcibly taking us to places where we've really never been.
So just in closing, on May 14th, there are protest rallies around the country, including here in Portland, in the fight against this upcoming Supreme Court ruling, and strategizing about how to move ahead in the fight for reproductive justice. Thanks, Mike. We'll continue to follow this, hopefully reporting better days.
Well, this could galvanize people, and it might ultimately have an effect far different than what its authors intended.
That's right.
That was Erica Badu, Agitation, from New America, Part 2. And before that, you heard Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss the political impact of the recent Supreme Court leaked document expressing the intent of SCOTUS to overturn Roe v. Wade. And of course, we can't underestimate the moment we are in, as abortion rights are under attack, with the very possible outcome that they be struck down completely in states all across the country. But as always, it is important to remember that reproductive rights do not begin and end with legal abortion. We Moles have long recognized the importance of building a movement that more broadly struggles for reproductive freedom and justice, and we will continue to take this up in our programming and organizing. And yesterday was Mother's Day, and related to all of this, of course, are the longstanding concerns about self-determination, motherhood, and parenting in a capitalist economy. Reflecting on past feminist organizing and thought, old mole Jan Hocken had this to say, quote, "One of the deepest prejudices against feminists promoted by conservatives involves the idea that feminists are anti-motherhood. The irony here is that feminists were the driving force behind bringing motherhood and reproductive labor into academia as important topics and vital to their disciplines, from the study of child rearing from the perspective of mothers to research on housework. In the 1970s and 80s, feminist scholars led a program of research exposing mother blaming in psychology and sociology, studies that falsely claimed that mental illness is caused by refrigerator mothers. Feminists have carried out research on the contributions of mothers beyond the household as well, including Mothers for Peace and other civic organizations related to the prevention of war. Because feminists have fought for the value of and dignity of mothers and mothering as necessary social labor, the imposition of motherhood against the will of a person has been viewed as a particularly obscene violation. For Mother's Day yesterday, we hope you hugged a feminist. You are listening to KBOO 90.7. I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Next, we hear from Bill Resnick and John Pfeffer on making peace in Ukraine.
Hello, John Pfeffer. Welcome to KBOO here in Portland, Oregon.
Thanks for having me on the show.
John Pfeffer is Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's written a great deal, articles, books, does interviews. For 2 years, he traveled in Eastern Europe and East Asia as an international representative for the American Friends Service Committee. His book, Aftershock, A Journey into Eastern Europe's Broken Dreams, that's Z Books, 2017, examines how the years of free market reforms have failed to deliver prosperity. Indeed, delivered corruption and organized crime in Eastern Europe, including the Ukraine. And he noted the early optimism in Eastern Europe gave way to bitterness and invigorated nationalism. Even so, he shows that against stiff odds, hope remains for the region's future. So he was really abundantly prepared for examining the Russian invasion of the Ukraine and has several articles in Foreign Policy and Focus on it. Russia is an authoritarian country run by kleptocrats and deserves no sympathy. But the U.S. drive for world domination include promises to Russia to not invite the former states of the Soviet Union into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization after the Soviet collapse. The Russians and all of them and the Russian people are afraid of another German invasion, German and Western invasion. Millions have been killed in Russia in the last 100 years. State after state, though, was invited and joined. Happening again and again, the broken promises were a precipitating factor for Russia's invasion. That the Ukraine, with its very long border with Russia, might get an invitation, that was the last straw. For those of you sickened by Russian shelling of Ukraine, be sure to avoid YouTube videos showing how the U.S. military in Iraq absolutely flattened the city of Fallujah. Documented Iraqi deaths from military operations totaled over 175,000. That's before the U.S. withdrew 20 years later. And really, who knows how many died anonymously out in the provinces and the poor neighborhoods of Baghdad. This war, of course, is new, but its repercussions and dangers are global. Russia could use what are called battlefield nuclear weapons, and the U.S. has them too. Arms budget Russia if it gets terribly desperate. Not impossible. Arms budgets are increasing across the major countries, and it seems a new Cold War is emerging. Very worrisome. Ukraine produces over 10% and Russia near 20% of the world exports of grain. Famine looms across the planet. And scientists in desperation tell us global warming is accelerating, that we risk the moment, perhaps soon, when the warming process becomes self-reinforcement and temperatures rise uncontrollably to make most of the planet uninhabitable. This is not science fiction, even if the world's elites don't want to face it because it would undermine their wealth and power. Immediately ending this war and focusing on our human priorities, these are actually absolute necessities that we want to survive, we might try that out. John Pfeffer points out that a settlement is very possible, and we discuss its terms. We also discuss what can be done in the U.S. and globally to force the elites and war industry into that settlement. First John, the terms and provisions of that settlement.
So the current negotiations are between Kiev and Moscow, between Ukraine and Russia. And at the end of April, or actually it's beginning of April, Ukraine presented a kind of 10-point approach that introduced such things as neutrality for the country. In other words, Ukraine would not join NATO, would not join any other security pacts. And that's kind of a major sticking point. That, of course, as I said, was one of the reasons why Putin launched the invasion in the first place, to take NATO off the agenda. But the sticking point is what kind of neutrality. And Ukraine says that it could agree to neutrality, but it would only do so if it got certain security guarantees. And those security guarantees look a lot like what a NATO membership would give you. In other words, a pledge by key powers to come to Ukraine's defense if it were invaded. So that's probably not something that Russia is going to agree to, but we'll see. That's the major sticking point there. Russia has a rather maximalist approach to what it would consider peace or what it would consider an appropriate end to this particular conflict. Russia wants to consolidate its territorial gains. As I said, it took control of Crimea. It has had de facto control over the Donbass, although prior to the invasion, it only controlled about somewhere around 30 or 35% of the Donbass in terms of the total territory. I think it aspires to control all of the Donbass, so all of Donetsk and Luhansk provinces, which would give it access to a lot of territory and a lot of natural resources. But it goes beyond that. Russia, it seems, also wants to consolidate its control over the southern reaches of Ukraine. It has seized control of the town of Kherson, really the only major town that it managed or has managed so far to take control of. But it is very close to having total control over Mariupol, the southern port, or what remains of Mariupol after nonstop Russian shelling. It aspires, of course, to move further west and take control of Odessa as well. In other words, basically turning Ukraine into a landlocked country, no access to ports. This would also serve the purpose of creating a land bridge between the Crimean Peninsula and Russia proper. So those are kind of territorial ambitions. Again, not easy to negotiate with Ukraine. Ukraine's not going to want to give up. Certainly not the territory it has lost as a result of the invasion, and not even the earlier losses, such as Crimea, even if it does not have any current prospects of retaking that territory. Where the United States comes in, well, the United States would be a kind of key guarantor of security in any kind of agreement. But other than that, the United States doesn't play a major role here. I mean, yes, it is supplying Ukraine with a lot of weaponry. It is leading the sanctions against Russia. So, yes, in terms of the overall environment, the United States has kind of an effective veto over certain agreements. But the real kind of nub, the real challenge here in terms of a negotiated settlement is resolving this conflict between the territorial ambitions of Russia and the willingness of Ukraine to entertain neutrality and what kind of neutrality that looks like. Some of the other issues, such as the composition of the Ukrainian government, Russia has said that it wants to denazify Ukraine, which is frankly a ridiculous demand, given the nature of the Ukrainian government and its Jewish leader. But I suspect that that won't be part of any kind of negotiated settlement. Possibly the disposition of Ukraine's military will be considered part of the issue of neutrality. But it will all ultimately boil down to, again, as I said, this conflict between Russia's territorial ambitions and Ukrainians' willingness to entertain some form of neutrality.
Yeah, I read it somewhere that land for peace compromises, they're imperfect and unprincipled in some ways, giving, bribing the aggressor, and they sometimes lead to even more demands. But this land for peace option is reasonable, and in the larger scheme of things, not unjust. But it won't be negotiated without pressure from the outside, and especially in the U.S. to have a peace movement joined by the far larger climate action forces. That's a necessity. My sense is that climate action, they're recognizing that a new Cold War is emerging, wasting vast resources needed for successful climate action. So, John Pfeffer, what do you see as the possibilities for pushing both sides? Indeed, China may well push the Russians to agree to something much, much less than they sought. What's the possibilities of that push to occur and succeed, for that pressure to occur and succeed?
Well, here in the United States, you know, the public opinion polls suggest that a very large majority of people both support sanctions against the Russian government, but also do not want the United States to be involved directly in a war. So this is kind of the middle ground for your average American. In terms of putting pressure on the U.S. government, I mean, the U.S. government, you know, it certainly needs more pressure to move in a climate-friendly direction. It's not so much pressure on the Biden administration, of course, but pressure on Congress and on key members of Congress to push through climate-related provisions in the Build Back Better bill. But in terms of on Ukraine policy, I mean, to be honest with you, I disagree with much of the U.S. peace movement's position, because the U.S. peace movement has generally taken a rather inadvertently supportive position of the Russian government. In other words, there are very few people in the U.S. peace movement who would come out and say that they support Moscow in its current invasion of Ukraine. But by opposing any kind of U.S. military assistance to Ukraine, they're effectively supporting Russian military efforts.
In their defense, they do call for nonviolent resistance, complete non-cooperation. And Ukraine's diverse people have shown such intelligence, ingenuity, and bravery and solidarity that it might well force the Russians to negotiate. The peace movement, though, it's so weak right now, and we need widespread upsurge from all justice and climate action forces to critique both imperial forces, the U.S. and Russia-China, not just the United States' effort to dominate, and, of course, to negotiate a settlement to this war and use our very ample resources to save the planet and our what we call civilization.
But in terms of putting pressure on other actors, I mean, you know, the actor that is the aggressor in this situation, Russia, is the one that is perhaps the one that's most vulnerable to pressure. The sanctions are having an impact on the Russian economy. They're having an impact on Russia's ability to continue its war effort by making it more difficult for Russian armament industry to supply and source the components for major weapon systems. And of course, the Russian army itself has sustained great losses and has rather low morale at this point. So there are pressure points here, and I think Russia is vulnerable. But of course, we don't want to push Russia into an absolute corner where it feels like it has nothing to lose and therefore has to either keep fighting in Ukraine in order to show some degree of success, or feels compelled to escalate and, you know, use weapons of mass destruction. So we want to avoid that as well. So it's a delicate balance, of course, putting sufficient pressure on Russia for it to end its current military engagement in Ukraine, and yet not so much pressure as to force the government there to act in extremely counterproductive ways.
John Pfeffer, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
No problem. It was a pleasure.
I saw a gray-haired mother crying softly in her door as she gazed upon the pathway where he'd return no more. Oh, Lord, love, hold my baby just once more. Jesus, wash the bloodstains from your hands. Will he welcome you into that peaceful land? Will he forgive the killing and the wars you have planned? Will Jesus wash the bloodstains from your hands?
That was Exene Cervenka from her 1990 solo album Running Scared. Before that, you heard Bill Resnick and John Pfeffer discuss the forces that could successfully bring peace to the Ukraine. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is KABU's annual spring drive, and now through May 28th, you can support KABU by becoming a member, renewing a membership, or just lending financial support to this vital resource. KABU is an important part of our community and an indispensable source of news, politics, and entertainment. And these are trying times indeed, and this morning I do want to encourage listeners to support KABU Radio and programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. We are volunteer-powered, non-commercial, independent, member-supported community radio, and we need your support to keep KABU on the air for another 50 years. Donate today at kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to 44-321 or mail your contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. I'm Denise Morris. I've been your host this morning, and we're going to conclude today's program with Joe Clement talking with Emily Drabinski, President-elect of the American Library Association. They discuss her winning campaign and building collective power to fight for public goods in and with the support of libraries. Joe?
Well, thanks, Denise. Well, welcome to the Old Mole, Emily Drabinski.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much.
Emily Drabinski was recently elected to be the president of the American Library Association. Her role from now until this time next year will be as president-elect, and then she'll serve her year-long term as president, and then after that, another year as the sitting past president, totaling 3 years. She's also currently a librarian of the Mina Reese Library of the CUNY Graduate Center in New York. Well, Emily's worked in libraries for more than 20 years and has a background as a labor organizer, too. Excitingly, she put these together when she ran for the ALA president on an inspiring platform of collective power for public good. It centered building unions in libraries, offering organizing education in library programming, and promoting a full spectrum of public goods and services outside of libraries. Well, before we talk about your campaign and vision for libraries in America, can you first tell us a bit about your background in libraries and with labor organizing?
Sure. So I started in libraries in 2001. I had been working for Lucky Magazine as a fact checker. It was like a magazine about shopping. And I made a mistake and I printed the number for like Saks Fifth Avenue on a spread about Barney's and got in so much trouble. I sleepless nights for a week. Was I going to get fired? Really intense. And I was like, I don't want my life to be consumed by the price of handbags. And that was a low moment in my life, but I just on a whim put in my application for a job at New York Public Library, got into their trainee program. So you could work in the library as a trainee doing sort of adult services, youth services, a little bit of everything, and they would pay for part of your library degree. So I did that, got my degree from Syracuse University's online program, worked for about 6 months as an indexer for the Social Science Index of H.W. Wilson. I was an area studies indexer. I had it for 6 months, landed my first academic job at Sarah Lawrence College, served as a reference librarian there for 4 years, got a job at Long Island University's Brooklyn campus, which was my first professional union position. And when I took that job, instantly got, I think, a $23,000 a year raise, and my annual leave was doubled or even tripled. Like, I just, the union difference was so intense and profound in terms of my quality of life. So I worked there for 10 years and then came over here to the Graduate Center at the City University of New York, and that's where I work now.
What about your background with labor organizing? What work have you done? Where have you learned how to organize?
You know, I grew up in a family that was pro-union in Idaho, which is kind of rare in Idaho, but I definitely had one of those. My dad was in the Postal Workers Union when I was a kid for a brief time and organized with his colleagues to get shorts to be allowed during summer. So there was like always a sense that unions were important in my family. And I knew from a very young age that, you know, you always support the players in a baseball strike, like you're always on the side of the workers. But, you know, you can know that in your brain, and then you can know that because you experience what management does to workers and the ways that the union is the only way that you can fight back in any kind of meaningful way. So when I got to LIU Brooklyn, that university is home to the first private higher ed union in the US. Anyway, but LIU was a mighty fighting faculty union and had been for a very long time. And I got there and like 2 years later, I was on strike for the first time. in my life, something that I thought happened in the olden days, you know, like I'm coming, you know, I'm like in the library, so we're not longshoremen. So I thought that the union would sort of negotiate the contract and then give it to me and then I would enjoy its benefits. And so then I was on strike and it was just mind altering, future altering experience. It's incredibly frightening. It is incredibly exciting. It is incredibly empowering. And we were only out for like 4 days, 5 days. And I show up to the ratification meeting with everybody else. And we're all in our t-shirts and they give us the contract and then ask us to ratify it like 20 minutes later. And I was like, oh, well, I thought we were going to like talk about this and decide whether or not we agreed with it. You know, I thought we were going to just deliberate as a democratic collective. And we didn't really. And we ended up ratifying a contract that included a bunch of cuts to the annual leave and earning potential of the librarians in the unit. And there were only about 13 of us in a 300 person unit. Our pay was docked more than we earned in the raises over the life of the contract, you know, all these things that you end up with a disappointing contract. And I think that's very normal, but it was like eye-opening to me where I was like, oh, if I want this to be different, I have to go and do it. So that's sort of where I got started. At the end of that contract, 5 years later, and we are bargaining again. And for the first time in the history of higher education in the United States, the faculty was locked out at the end of contract negotiations. And that, like, there's being on strike and then there's being locked out. You're like fired en masse. You have no say in when you go back to work. You're not getting paid. Your health insurance is canceled. They've hired scabs to teach all the classes. It happened over Labor Day weekend. And it just was the most intense experience of management power that I'd ever seen or heard about. It's like unheard of, right? Like I have lots of union friends and that hadn't happened to them. Your longshoreman has happened to you, but if you're in the library, it doesn't happen, you know, because like, you can't have a university without teachers. And so it was like, oh, they don't care about that. They care about control and they care about profit. Even in nonprofits, they care about revenue generation and they care about control. And they're willing to put 300 people out of work in New York City with a day's notice because they want those things more than they want the university to continue. So that's where I really learned my organizing chops. I learned like how important it is to be prepared when management comes at you like that. I learned that management is always going to management, right? That it doesn't matter if they're good people or nice people, or you have a good time in their meetings. And like, even if you're really good friends, and I have very good friends on the other side of the fight, but in those moments of antagonism, there's nothing personal there. You're just part of these forces. And that if you want to counter management tools, which are vast, right? They have so much capacity. You have to build that power together. So I learned a lot from our organizers with the American Federation of Teachers. I learned a lot from colleagues in Labor Notes, people in the Teamster for a Democratic Union. Everybody sort of saw what was happening to us and knew that if we could organize and push back against that, that it would be a labor win for everybody, which I think in the end of the day it was.
So how did you decide then to turn those experiences on the strike line, being locked out with Labor Notes and as a librarian into the campaign for the ALA president?
So for me, I think once I organized with others, you know, in pursuit of some goal that we shared that was about justice and equity, like I just always want to be organizing. And so when the pandemic hit, I took over as interim chief librarian at my library. So I was out of the unit, right? I was management. That's the first time, and I'm guessing it may be the last time I'm in a management position. But what it meant was that I could not organize with my comrades around wages and working conditions at CUNY. So where am I going to put that energy, right? I look at the world and like, if you're not organizing to make the world different, I'm not sure how you get up every morning because it's very dismal and very grim. And I'm a believer in workplace organizing now that I've done it. That's just where I want to put my energies, and all other kinds of organizing work is important too. But what I saw was library workers very angry, put into unsafe situations, facing layoffs and furloughs that they had no control over, and just like all this stuff that is always going to happen to you at some point in your working life, but it never really happens en masse to everybody in a field all at the same time. Like the pandemic did seem to me to be a mass organizing event, right? If we say management is the best organizer, and I definitely believe that, we were all organized by management in this moment, right? we are subject to the whims of people who, in many cases, don't care if we live or die because they're not thinking about us as people. Wouldn't say it to our face, but when dealing with a class of people are like fine rendering some of us disposable. And so I thought like it was really kind of on a whim that ALA, because it represents my workplace, like essentially it's like library workers or librarians, and we can talk more about that. So an association that does a lot of advocacy work, but maybe has less experience or less like currently does less work around organizing about an analysis of collective power, maybe I could go in and bring some of that energy and do some cool work. But then you win and you have to govern. And I saw a great talk by Barbara Mataloni once. She ran as part of a reform slate in the Massachusetts Teachers Union. And out of the slate, she was the only one who won and she was the president. You know, so like, what are you going to do? So now I'm like, oh, that was fun. But organizing for what we want out of ALA with me in a leadership position and what that's going to look like, that's the project for me going forward.
One of your big planks is bringing unions into libraries, but also bringing unions and organizing education into the types of things that libraries offer and support the public with. Can you talk a bit more about both of those?
I think the state of labor education in this country is not strong, right? Almost none of us grow up anymore in strong union households. We're not, you know, as unions have been actively decimated by capital in the state over the last many decades, most of us don't understand how unions can make a difference in the quality of our lives. And if you look, every time if you're unionized, you'll make more money every time. And you'll hear people say, well, I was able to negotiate for a higher rate because of how special and awesome I am, and the union would make it so I couldn't do that. And so I also think like a sense of the collective is really not robust in this country, maybe to say the least. And so we have to give people both the language to talk about a collective experience that we're all having, which is, you know, increasing management control and decreasing wages. And for people to understand that that's not special or unique to them or their library, but it's in fact something that every worker is experiencing, and that the remedy is not making a better argument or being madder in public. It's organizing, you know, in really specific and material ways to get what's ours. And so that's just not a conversation that people are able to have most of the time, because most of the time people who ascend to a position like president of ALA are like, they're not unionists. You know, they may be pro-union, but they're not, you know, I'm a true blue believer, you know? So I think, I mean, someone at the top who could talk about unions and make sure that they're a part of every conversation we have about libraries as the primary mechanism for change in most of our institutions, there's value in just like from the 30,000 foot view, like we're talking about labor. And my hope is that that will make it easier for people to talk with their colleagues on the ground, because we need language around it.
When you talk with folks who work in libraries, I think you have a spectrum of perspectives on power. And there's famously, you know, this commitment to neutrality in libraries mm-hmm. as like how we are foundation of a pluralistic democratic society. And at the same time, there are a lot of ways in which that very project itself is inherently political and draws on other political projects in the context of, you know, human society. How do you see bringing those two elements together to make better libraries?
When you think about libraries as a site for democracy and universal access to knowledge and information and a place where all different viewpoints can get heard in the public square, I mean, I'm for all of those things, but I'm a materialist. And so I know that if I'm going to have one book on the shelf, it's going to take up that space on the shelf to the exclusion of another book that could equally sit on that shelf, right? And so every decision that we make about space and resource allocation, which is really all libraries do, right? Like I know we're all supposed to be innovating and thinking about the library of the future, but at the end of the day, we occupy real estate in our cities and towns. We produce space for people to come in and use the bathroom and sit down and plug something into an outlet and maybe get a book or take their kid to a reading or do a craft program or whatever, right? Like it's public, you know, we take money shared with us, like that everybody should share it in common, and we use it to buy things like staplers and envelopes and books and TVs and whatever. So like that's inherently a power project because it's a project of allocating resources to some things and not others. And so there's no universe where that's not a real thing in the library, which is what I love about it. I think of it in terms of that, like our job is as stewards of the public purse, right? Of the social wage, we decide where it goes. And that's a position with a whole lot of power. And I think we don't do ourselves any favors by pretending that it isn't, right? And then in fact, it is. And it means that we want to have more power. We want to take up more real estate. We want to expand, and we want like more of the public inside of our buildings and more of the people in our communities working with us and for us. And so that's like inextricable from a political project. And like, you can only imagine that you're apolitical if you are dominant, right? None of us who have any experience as non-dominant in any way, you know, you know that it's not neutral because you can't find books about yourself on the shelf. They frisk you when you walk in. They think you have a gun when you walk in the door. Like we know that these are not apolitical projects. And so the idea that it's neutral, the push to sort of maintain that as a core tenet of librarianship is like a commitment to a status quo that excludes a lot of us.
And one way libraries are not neutral is how in every library system in this country, you will find programs and other things offered by the library that teach you how to start a small business, mm-hmm. how to enhance your entrepreneurial skills, how to monetize your hobbies that reflect the interests, ideas, and values of commerce. And the reality is that most of our patrons are working class and are not necessarily looking to leave their jobs. And they have rights as far as what they can do about their work conditions and other things that happen to them at work. And there's a role for libraries to be playing in promoting democracy at work if they are champions of democracy.
Absolutely. Yes.
You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7. Community Radio. A big thank you to KBOO staff who have kept our non-commercial community radio on the air 24/7 over these last 2 years. It takes a labor. Thanks to our contributors and guests for making today's show possible, Old Mole's Jan Hawken, Mike Snedeker, Bill Resnick, and Joe Clement, and our guest John Pfeffer, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Emily Drabinsky, President-elect of the American Library Association. And thanks also to Patricia Kohlberg for promotional support and John Nelson for editing portions of today's program. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The Old Mole goes where corporate media will not, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. You can hear The Old Mole weekly at 9 a.m. on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. It is KBOO's annual spring membership drive for 2022, and KBOO's independent, locally produced, people-powered community radio is only possible with your support. So support KBOO, support the Old Mole, and all the great programming on our community radio station. Become a member today by going to kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or mail your contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. I am Denise Morris, and I've been your host for this morning's Old Mole. Tune in next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, and anti-racist perspective.